Today we want to focus on El Salvador specifically, particularly about current events. This is a moment of some potential for peace, though there have been many moments for peace before. So we want to look at what are the elements right now that may lead to a negotiated political settlement of this long conflict in El Salvador. And within that framework, perhaps we need to look at events of the last 6 months or so, the offensive of last November being probably a key moment, a watershed moment that we need to look at. And Mavis is going to give us some introduction on that.
I just want to begin by talking, as Phil said, about the events that led up to the November offensive and the transition from the Christian Democratic Party within that process leading up to November, the transition from the Christian Democratic Party and President Duarte to the Arena Party, the Nationalist Republican Alliance, and President Cristiani. It's only about a year and a half ago, during the Salvadoran presidential campaign, that the Duarte government, the Army, and the United States, in conjunction, the three of them, refused an FMLN proposal to postpone the elections for 6 months, which would have given the FMLN a chance to organize politically, to participate actively in the elections, and to give them a chance to organize their constituency enough so that they might have had a reasonable chance to make an impact in those elections. But the government, the Army, the U.S. Embassy refused that proposal, and elections went on as they were planned in March of 1989. Duarte's government, prior to those elections, had failed in all of its stated objectives. The two most important of those objectives were achieving peace, bringing an end to the war, and overcoming, changing, reversing the economic crisis in the country. So the elections were duly held in March of 1989. The FMLN boycotted the elections. Some violence took place on election day. 44 people were killed that day in electoral day of violence, including three journalists who were shot by the military forces. A minority of the electorate actually voted that day. And what they decided was to change the people who manage what I would call the U.S. project in El Salvador. And so Alfredo Cristiani, the Arena candidate, who was meant to more or less polish the image of Arena. The Arena party has been the party that's been connected with the death squad. It's the party of Roberto d'Aubuisson, who is infamous for his alleged involvement in the murder of Archbishop Romero. So Alfredo Cristiani won the election with 53.8% of the vote. The victory, however, I think was somewhat deceptive, with over half of the voters who are eligible to vote in El Salvador abstaining. As a matter of fact, fewer people voted for the Arena Party in 1989 than voted against it in 1984 when Duarte was elected. A poll from the Catholic University, the Jesuit University in El Salvador, estimated that 54% of the voting public abstained from voting after the elections were, the refusal to postpone the elections for 6 months. The elections in El Salvador have really lost credibility as a means for achieving change and a means for solving the problems that the people see within their society. So, with the election in March 19, Duarte began a lame duck period from March through June. And what happened was that the Arena Party's victory emboldened probably the most violent elements of the party. It emboldened the armed forces. It emboldened the security forces. So that between January and March, before the elections, there had been a monthly average of 31 violent actions against the people. For example, disappearances, assassinations, detentions, attacks against the civilian population. The number jumped to 130 in April, immediately following the elections. It followed with 82 in July, 116 in September, 73 in October. So the average of violent actions against the people jumped dramatically after the election. And actually, there was frank repression in April. Today, a long year later, Duarte is dead. The ultra-rightist Arena Party has been in power now for a year. But we do see this, as Phil said, new possibility for some negotiations between the government and the FMLN, which maybe there's a little crack in the door. But again, let's talk a little bit more about this time leading up to the offensive. At the beginning of 1989, the FMLN had outlined a two-pronged strategy that they publicly said they intended to carry out throughout that period of time. The first strategy was to promote creative and reasonable negotiating proposals, to present these as a way for El Salvador possibly to move toward peace, to move toward democratization, with some social justice for the people. The second prong of their strategy was one of carrying out strong military actions and encouraging mass participation within the cities especially in the FMLN project. And so that meant sabotage, it meant attacks upon military targets, it meant some attacks upon military officials' homes. With the increased violence in March after the elections, the FMLN responded in like kind, increasing also its violent actions. For example, this is February, during the time of the election period, a former FMLN comandante, Miguel Castellanos, who was found working within an army think tank, was assassinated by the FMLN. A ex-Jesuit priest who became a rightist ideologue, Dr. Francisco Pecorini, was assassinated. The Attorney General was assassinated with a very strong car bomb where this was during rush hour traffic one morning. A person ran up, placed a car bomb on the top of the car in which he was riding on the passenger side. The bomb was constructed in such a way that the explosion was downward. It killed the Attorney General and the driver remained basically unharmed. He may have gotten a couple of scratches, but the direction of the bomb was obviously toward the Attorney General. In June of that year, 1989, right after the inauguration of President Cristiani, his minister to the presidency, Dr. Rodriguez Port, was assassinated. The FMLN, by the way, never took responsibility for that particular assassination. The home of the vice president, Francisco Merino, was bombed. The FMLN also didn't take responsibility for that action, but they did say, well, he deserved it. We didn't do it, but whoever did it, we support them. Also, the FMLN launched a campaign at the end of June against Arena's proposed anti-terrorist laws, which were draconian reforms of the penal code, which equated social activities, social actions, social protest with terrorism. Similarly, following an announcement in August of some tax hikes which caused the owners of the bus company to raise bus prices dramatically, the FMLN launched an attack against the transportation system and destroyed by burning approximately or more than 50 buses during a period of just a couple of months. So they saw this strategy as intensifying their activities that they felt were in favor of the masses of the people and against those kinds of activities by the government that were not in favor of the masses or the interests of the people. And violence such as this continued throughout the year on both sides. During this time, after Arena took power, there began some peace talks in September and October. In talks with the FMLN, it soon became clear, at least to the FMLN, that Arena was not negotiating seriously or not willing to negotiate seriously, and that they were assuming that the FMLN was negotiating or talking out of weakness, that they were forced into these talks with the government because they were in a weak position, militarily and politically. So with this determination by the FMLN that the negotiations were not serious, they really ended in a stalemate. They went nowhere. The FMLN had predicted that there would be a social explosion if negotiations did not gain something for the people, did not actually happen. This didn't happen. The social explosion didn't happen, but a massive FMLN offensive did happen. In desperation, the armed forces at this time gave really free rein to their most extremist elements, and we ended up with resulting indiscriminate bombing against civilian population. We ended up with the assassination of the 6 Jesuit priests and the 2 women domestic workers at the Catholic University. I think that these 2 events, this indiscriminate bombing and the assassination of the Jesuits, in essence changed the course of events of that war. The FMLN had demonstrated its strength. The government and the armed forces had demonstrated their savagery. So, when the FMLN decided that the negotiations were not serious, and one way that they demonstrated this was the fact that with every agenda item on the negotiating table, the government team had to receive a red light or a green light from a team of high military officials who were present at the talks, and so everything had to be checked out with the military. It became clear that the government team really didn't have the authority to go ahead and negotiate on behalf of the government and with some real strength. So on November 30th, which was about 2 weeks after the breakoff of the, October 30th, after the breakoff of the October talks, the FMLN attacked the high command of the military, and the military responded immediately the next day with an attack upon the Committee of Mothers office, a bomb placed there, and also a bomb placed midday in the offices of a union federation called Finastris. The Committee of Mothers bomb wounded 4 people. The bomb that was placed at Finastris killed 10 people. It was placed in a kitchen area where people had congregated for their noon lunch. One of the people who was killed in that bombing was a woman who is a member of the executive committee of the UNTS, which is the most broadest coalition federation of labor unions in the country, and one of the real strong critical voices against the government and military. This kind of brutal reaction against civilian organizations, done in broad daylight, done very openly, with people obviously going to be present, led the FMLN to suspend the talks that had been scheduled for the first days of November in Caracas, Venezuela. And the FMLN then took the alternative route of violence, bringing the war into the city. So on November 11th, which was a Saturday morning, the FMLN attacked the National Guard barracks in San Salvador, and in the course of the day attacked a number of other military targets. But by nightfall, it was clear that their objective was to become ensconced or set up within some of the working class peripheral neighborhoods of the capital city. Also in some of the larger cities in the outer parts of the country, in San Miguel especially. The armed forces, upon the FMLN's presence in the city, bragged that they'd be able to end this offensive within 48 hours and that they would be able to dislodge the guerrillas almost immediately. They called a state of emergency. They set up a curfew between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. the next morning and suspended all constitutional guarantees. But the resistance of the revolutionary forces really surprised them, both the government and the military. The military radio, Radio Cuscatlan, took over all of the means of communication, all of the radio stations, all of the TV stations, and broadcast on their own network. And they spewed out, actually, hate for so many of the revolutionary leaders and people who were, you wouldn't call revolutionary leaders either. They broadcast threats against the 2 San Salvador bishops, Bishop Rivera Damas and Bishop Rosa Chavez. They broadcast threats against the rector of the Catholic University, Ignacio Ellacuría, and other Jesuits at the university. They broadcast threats against Rubén Zamora and Guillermo Ungo, 2 of the opposition political leaders. Then on November 16th, I'm sure that you all remember reading about the murder of the 6 Jesuits and the 2 domestic workers, a brutal, horrific murder, which was done during the curfew hours, during the the late or early morning hours, and interestingly enough, was done, according to witnesses, very loudly. They did not go about their task quietly, and it took a number of hours. And yet there was no response from security forces, from the military, which were located approximately a kilometer from where the murders were committed. No one came to the rescue. No one came to find out what was going on. The murders having taken place during curfew hours meant that only the army had free access to the streets, had the possibility to move around. That same night was the night of the beginning of the indiscriminate bombings of these civilian areas where the FMLN was located. Bombings that Phil can talk about more. He was there watching it from a hotel window. It was interesting also that this kind of indiscriminate bombing that they carried out against the poor barrios was not a luxury that they could afford. About a week later, when the FMLN took up positions within the wealthy area of Escalon and occupied the Sheraton Hotel, that kind of bombing did not happen in those areas. The designers of El Salvador's low-intensity warfare project, I don't think, had counted upon this kind of panic, this kind of fanaticism by the armed forces. And these acts, these murders of the Jesuits, this indiscriminate bombings in the civilian barrios, ripped away the democratic facade, the democratic mask that has been maintained or tried to be maintained about the project of low-intensity warfare. And so after 9 years of working to professionalize the Salvadoran army, this dissolved in one night of more or less bestiality against the Jesuits. Along with that, the bipartisan consensus in Congress began to break apart over our Salvadoran policy. People began to see somewhat more the justice of the FMLN's demands for meaningful peace negotiations. It also showed, I think, that the FMLN was not weak, such as Arena had projected, and that's why negotiations were going nowhere, because Arena thought that the FMLN was negotiating out of weakness. The offensive proved that that wasn't so. The FMLN could move its troops into the city. It could sustain itself within the city for more than 12 days under heavy bombing attacks. The thesis that the FMLN was weak was proven wrong. However, the cost, obviously, to the civilian population for this proof was very great. Thousands of people lost their homes. Thousands of people lost their homes. A couple of thousand were killed. The effect on the civilian population, I think, was interesting. It caused some of those people who had been supporters of the FMLN to back away a little bit and criticize the FMLN leadership, saying, how can you have done this? How can you have brought your troops into a civilian area, knowing the chances that the army would come in and really aggressively attack? It had the opposite effect on other people. Many people who had been involved in the unions and some of the other popular organizations took up the option of incorporating themselves into the fighting force of the FMLN. So you saw former supporters of the guerrilla going both ways, some being critical of this action, some saying, all right, this is our last alternative, and taking up arms themselves. I think, though, that with this offensive, the Salvadoran conflict really entered a new phase. It became clear to everyone, the military, the government, the FMLN, the U.S. Embassy, that the key is not to be found in a military conflict, the key is not to be found in a military victory or a military balance of powers. The key is probably to be found in the political confrontation of these two different forces who have two different conceptions of society. So then from offensive, we now move into a stage toward negotiations, toward some possibilities for real negotiations between two sides of more or less equal strength or legitimacy.
Perhaps we could see if there are some questions at this point. And I don't know if there are any questions around the period of the offensive.
Could you briefly characterize the social differences between the Iranian party power bases and where their money and support is coming from within El Salvador, not just from our government, but and also from the FMLN.
Well, IRENA is a rightist party. It's a party formed from the oligarchy. Cristiani himself is from a coffee-producing family, a wealthy family. He's U.S. educated. He was educated in Georgetown University, speaks English fluently. The support base has been the industrialists, the landowners, the oligarchy, some factions of the armed forces, though some of the armed forces also are Christian democratic supporters. But certainly from the more wealthy segments of society. But you can't say only that either, because interestingly enough, when you'd go to some of the IRENA rallies during the election, you would see people from all stratas of society there, from most humble campesinos to obviously wealthy youth wearing Jerbo jeans and Nike tennis shoes and obviously do their shopping in Miami. So you saw all sorts of kinds of people there. I think similarly to what happened in Nicaragua, people are so tired of war that the option of IRENA, which was really the only option that people had other than the Christian Democrats, even though there was the presence of a leftist political coalition, the issue of fear was there. They weren't as well organized, as well financed, as well. They didn't have time to do campaigning such as IRENA did. IRENA was well financed. It had public relations advisors that helped them run a very, very slick campaign. So you'd go to their rallies, and, there were flags, and there was music, and there was cheering, and there was singing. And you'd go to a Convergencia rally, which is the leftist coalition, and people would come to those. But they'd stand there with their arms at their sides and a totally benign look on their face. There was no clapping, there was no cheering, there was no nothing. And one of my friends, who is a leader in that political party, said, well, this time we got them at least to come to our rallies. Next time, the next election, maybe we'll even get them to clap. But the fear issue is there. But going back to IRENA, it's from all stratas, but certainly their base and their financial base is within the wealthy part of the country.
And FMLN then is strictly indigenous, you think, or all the question I press more direct is, what is the influence of Sandinista in FMLN, and what the red peril dealing with that question?
It's got a long history. Yeah. It is primarily indigenous, though it is not in isolation from other realities. And certainly there's been a political space and probably some logistical space from Managua, from the Sandinistas. It's interesting that the Sandinistas and the FMLN have periodic conversations at high levels, where they air out strategies and a lot of differences. And they are two different dynamics. And sometimes they're in disagreement with each other. But there is no doubt that the El Salvador revolutionary process in some way was certainly there was an injection of a spirit of hope that by armed revolutionary means you could attain something like happened in Nicaragua. And certainly Nicaragua was interested also in seeing that kind of revolutionary change came about in other areas. So it is certainly not correct to say that there is no connection. I think on the other hand, to assume that El Salvador depends upon Nicaragua and therefore, say, Cuba, Soviet Union, is also a fallacy. There are enough means, there's enough cunning within the Salvadoran people to carry on their own revolutionary struggle, and enough reasons. I mean, it's inspired, and we can get to a bit of that. It's got more than a century of history. Yeah. But it is not in isolation either from world realities, as we talked about last night. Eastern Europe, the events there, will impact the reality of Central America.
Where do the FMLN get their arms and to carry on the struggle?
That's a very good question. And primarily, their arms are very simple. The most sophisticated at the moment are now some AK-47s from the Soviet Union. Primarily, they've used up to the last couple of years the M16s and the G3s, which they can buy primarily on the international arms market, or they have gained in combat with the Salvadoran armed forces. There's also a lot of documented evidence, and I have personal knowledge of the fact that the Salvadoran military has sold weapons to the FMLN.
As have the Contras.
That's another. A lot of the AK-47s came from the U.S.-backed Contras. When it was clear to the Contras that there would no longer be support to them for their struggle within Nicaragua, they felt that they had no longer any use for these weapons and began to sell them across the border to El Salvador. The whole question of arms trafficking is tremendous. Mm-hmm. Now there's a primary tool of the FMLN are manufactured weapons, very simple
homemade
bombs and landmines, which are atrocious, and you see so many people without limbs, hands, or legs. Which is not only the case in El Salvador, but you find it in other of these conflicts as well, Angola being another primary example.
And it's not only Nicaragua. FMLN that uses the landmines, the Army also uses them.
They also have manufactured small rockets that go on the end of an M16. And so it has an impact, and they've shot down helicopters and a few other planes. Recently, and after the time of the offensive, it looks like they've also acquired some surface to air missiles for the purpose of knocking down some of these planes that did so much damage in the civilian areas. It's not clear yet, as you may recall, about the second week of the offensive last year, there was a plane that crashed in El Salvador, and some dozen or two dozen SAM-7s or so were found. That's a very suspicious incident yet. It's not clear how that airplane arrived there, or why it crashed, why, though the airplane was totally destroyed, none of the SAM weapons were at all destroyed or exploded.
And the packing list was found in the plane also.
So, you know, it may have been a way to try to contrive a connection to Nicaragua. I don't, in my own judgment, deny that there have been transfer of weapons from Nicaragua to El Salvador. The United States government always contends that, yet it has never really come through with a lot of tremendous evidence to that effect. It is true that there is a tremendous arms flow into El Salvador. I think one of the tragedies of the whole Central America region in the last decade is this tremendous militarization, armament escalation in the whole region.
How is it affected by all the other countries? You talked about Nicaragua, and how is it affected, like with Honduras? In terms of arms, are you talking the whole Central America in terms of connections with militarism and arms?
Yes, and weapons do come through Honduras and through Guatemala. I mean, as avenues of getting weapons in, and they probably come in a lot of trucks and back roads and stuff.
So, do people work together in all the different countries? I mean, are there groups within countries that work together?
There are networks on all sides to all of this, and there are international networks. This is an international. There are international connections. It goes to the United States. Many of the weapons are purchased directly from the United States, Europe, Eastern and Western Europe.
Yeah. Where do they get funding to buy that?
That also is a good question. There's international support for revolutionary movements, that's clear. Some of which comes from Latin America, others which comes from Western and Eastern Europe and the United States. One of the, going back into the period of the 70s, there was a period where the FMLN, well, at that time it was not the FMLN, but the guerrillas of El Salvador, did a lot of kidnapping of industrialists and held them for hostage. They were pretty high ransoms paid, $1 million or so. Some of that money was lent to the FSLN, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, to assist them in waging their struggle against Somoza. And so there were some debts paid back to the FMLN, not only by the Sandinistas, but by others. So it's an interesting thing. You can go back to the time of Torrijos in Panama, who was a military leader, and he assisted the Sandinistas in getting weapons to a large degree. He was not in favor of the downfall of the military apparatus in El Salvador, on the other hand. But there are those kinds of international connections. And again, it's a reason why the United States was not in support of Torrijos in Panama. He died in an air accident. A lot of accusations have been made that perhaps that was an assassination. But still remains a mystery.
Isn't it true that American advisors are actually involved in the fighting up into the degree of when shooting takes place, including target acquisition from KC-135s with sophisticated infrared in order to find the guerrillas in their home mm-hmm. places? And well, although the Americans don't pull triggers, mm-hmm. they just find mm-hmm. they use more of the sophisticated equipment that they're not willing to give to the Salvador government.
Well, that latter item I don't know about. I think that certainly the involvement of U.S. military advisors and training and sort of going out on reconnaissance trips and actual trying to seek out the FMLN, there's no doubt that that takes place. I mean, there are supposedly restrictions on the engagement of U.S. Military in the war itself, in the conduction of the war. My own thinking is that it's not necessary to assume then that the United States officers have to be there or other military to conduct the actual fighting itself. The Salvador military are very capable of doing that, and they want to do it. They're as adamant about that as we are. And also, in terms of their technical capability, they're as technically capable as we have trained them. Huh? So I'm not aware that all of the military capacity that we have given them has to be tuned. I think during the offensive, for example, the decision to use the Air Force was totally a Salvadoran decision. Help me with the name, Bustamante? Bustillo was the name of the general who directed the Air Force. I think he just went on his own vendetta against the civilian population, trying to get at the FMLN. There was nobody that could control that decision, the use of that Air Force power. There was an interesting incident about the same time took place in the Philippines where there was an attempted coup against Corazon Aquino, where some rebellious troops tried to get off the ground and wage some kind of a war. And the U.S. Air Force in Manila kept the Air Force on the ground. There were some who thought it would be the responsibility of the United States Air Force to try to keep the Salvadoran Air Force on the ground or come in and destroy it as the only way to counterattack this force that had gone absolutely ballistic.
It seems that Christiani has not been able to sort of rein in the military or at least establish some sort of control. What does that mean for the negotiations? I mean, what role does the military have in that? I mean, they seem like they have to be a really key player.
Oh, yeah. It's clear. The history indicates very clearly that that it is the military who has the power.
And they understand they have their own bank now? Or they have
and that's not unusual in Latin America. But it has become a more powerful economic element, and that is changing the power structure within El Salvador. Indeed, that now you not only have the industrial and landed wealthy, but you have an independently wealthy military. So they are getting involved in investments and banking and stuff like that. But you're raising a critical point. What is this relationship between a civilian, democratically elected president, and the military there? And it's clear that Christiani does not have absolute power over that military, and much less over paramilitary or factions within the military and the police. And the death squads, who may not be necessarily in the military, but are civilians. And so that's the balancing act that's going on right now. And the United States proposal, its project, is to try to create this aura of a civilian government. And it would say to strengthen those kinds of civilian structures. The fact is that not much goes on within the civilian structures. It certainly did not under the Duarte era. In all of the areas that we worked with, Lutheran World Federation, and it's true of any organization that was working in the area, the military had the power. They had the ultimate word in terms of where people could go to work among the poor, what kind of assistance you could bring in, food or housing material and the like. So the key issue now around the peace talks is primarily around the military and its structure and its apparatus and the judicial system.
I think another issue, not just the military, but can Christiani control forces within his own party? Because during the campaign, one of the very open slogans that you heard chanted was, Christiani to the presidency, D'Aubusson to the power. Mm-hmm. So he is still a very strong force within that party and within that country, even though he's taking more of a shadowy role now, where he's not as much out front. He's the president for life of the Arena Party. He is very much present in, I think, any decisions that are made within that government.
But what's the relation between the Arena Party and the military? I mean, is this two sides of the same coin, or are they really independent in some way?
Interesting because the military commanders that I have gotten to know a bit and have spent some time talking with, if you really probe, would more identify themselves with the Christian Democrats than they would with ARENA. So there's not necessarily a symbiotic relationship there. It's more of a head-to-head relationship, I think, in some ways. They've got a convergence of some goals, I think, but I don't think the Army is about to sit back and say to ARENA, all right, now that you're in power, you go ahead and take over, and we'll take orders from you. In no way, they're still going to want to maintain their own power structures and their own ability to call the shots.
One thing on the question of the relationship of Christiani to the military, one test case obviously is the case of the Jesuits. Mm-hmm. Is he willing to push that politically, which would mean the conviction of some high-level military? Does he have the political clout really to to do that and remain there? Or by doing so, would he run the danger of a military coup against him? And I think that's where the United States is playing a critical role as trying to maintain the civilian imagery, so you don't, you try to achieve some similar goals, but maintain this civilian facade. Dan has a question.
I'm interested in hearing more about how you, where you see the Jesuit case going and what, if that's stalemate right now.
That's right.
But the other question I have, in addition, is I understand that immediately following the offensive, that many of the leaders of the popular organizations and the churches were forced either underground or out of the country. I know, like the Lutheran Church, many of the people I know that were found literally all over the world within a week after that offense because of the death threats, so forth. What has happened with the church leaders and leaders of the popular groups? Have some been able to go back? Are people coming back from underground? Are some still in hiding? What's the atmosphere like for those groups now?
Very good. First, you asked about the Jesuit case. This is the interim report of the Speaker's Task Force, Foley, House Speaker, on the assassination of the Jesuits, in which Joe Moakley, who headed the task force, outlines their frustration with the process of any kind of conviction. It has been a stalemate, though. In the last week or so, there was testimony by another high-level military person on the destruction of some of the evidence. So they're probably trying to get some kind of progress on it. As you may know, linked to all of that is the first vote back in mid-May, to reduce military aid from the United States to El Salvador by 50%, which went through, later defeated in another bill. So it's beginning to have some effect in our own congressional legislation. With regard to the popular movements, the churches, most people did have to go underground or be very, very cautious during the days of the offensive, and many left the country. I personally was engaged in a lot of assistance to people from the popular movements and the churches, primarily Bishop Medardo Gomez and Baptist pastor Edgar Palacios, who's the president of the National Debate for Peace in El Salvador. Though many of the people in the popular organizations initially felt that they needed to stay and try to organize find some space to end the conflict, an immediate end of the conflict. That's how Medardo saw his role, and Edgar Palacios, through the National Debate for Peace process. However, after the assassination of the Jesuits, after the detention of many foreigners who were then expelled from the country, and clearly not only were the Jesuits assassinated, there were people lined up against walls and assassinated, and there were mass graves that were built, and then the bombing from the air. By the way, about 2,000 deaths of civilians, if you extrapolate that out, is about the equivalent of 100,000 U.S. Civilians killed by your own Army and Air Force. That's double about the loss of lives of U.S. service people in the Vietnam conflict over a period of several years. So it was a horrendous period. Many people went to Guatemala, many went to Mexico, and after a period of time, many have gone back. So that at this moment, many are, again, operating with a lot of fear, certainly, but again, openly. On May 1st of this year, Labor Day, there's traditionally a large march. Even still under the state of emergency within El Salvador, the people decided to march, led by the labor unions, but also the National Debate for Peace got behind that march, which coalesces about 60 non-political organizations, including people in the business sector, people in the churches, all walks of life, students. And I think it was the largest demonstration that's happened in many years. About 30,000 people were on the streets. So it is, again, and that's something that's quite important, that the people are seeking peace, and that's a force that cannot be denied. How to achieve peace is the question, and that's still a negotiated settlement between the FMLN and the Armed Forces government of El Salvador. We could walk through briefly.
One of the things that happened then with this, whether people come back or not, has to do with whether they incorporated into the armed struggle. We have, you and I both have a number of friends, and you may or may not know who they are, who have been people that we have dealt with in the popular organizations who at the time of the offensive decided that their option now became one of armed revolution, and they took up arms. That caused significant problems for those organizations who have always been under the accusation of being a front for the guerrilla. And so now all of a sudden some of their top leaders are found out in the streets with a M16 fighting. And it has been a real difficult problem for those organizations, unions and some of the human rights groups and some of the Christian committees for the displaced, who want to now come back and openly work again. They have to find ways to explain the fact that this person who was one of their upfront leaders is now incorporated into the guerrilla. So even though a lot of people have come back, they're doing it very cautiously. Many of them have changed offices so that they're located in different places. Some of them are keeping those places secret. Others are more openly celebrating their reopening. But there are a number of people who won't be coming back and who have caused problems for those who wanted to maintain their nonviolent stance.
You mentioned the two parties. What about the Christian Democrats? What can you give us back?
Well, they were split in the last elections, and it was, and it was very clear too that they had not achieved what they had set out in their political platform to do, that is, achieve peace and bring economic recovery to the country. So, I mean, it's just unfortunate to say it, but it was the Duarte era just was totally ineffective in bringing about that. And it's interesting that under Arena, there are some more technical capacity, there's better organization than under the Christian Democrats by far. And that was clear, for example, in the massive repatriation of some refugees into El Salvador, even during the time and immediately after the offensive, November and then into January, February, March of this year. There are some things that there's some well-trained, expert people within Arena, and they can get things done. They also do have a political base. They have organization. The Christian Democrats really don't have a political base of people. They don't have a social. It's a construct. It's an ideology, and around that you have some people like Duarte. But it doesn't have its own following within the country. It's got a relatively recent history. Just want to make you aware of one other recent report by the Arms Control Foreign Policy Caucus. It examines the profile of El Salvador's military leaders. And here are the top military leaders of the country, and it shows how they have been involved in killings of non-combatants in custody, other killings of non-combatants, torture or abuse, falsification of facts, disappearances, denial of medical care. And you'll find that the entire top military command of the armed forces is involved in human rights abuses. What I've done up here is put kind of a chronology, a history of El Salvador. I mean, it's a long process, but looking at at the peace process. And really, the struggle has always been one of the rich against the poor. You can go back to 1932, where there was a popular uprising to try to correct some of that inequity. But it resulted in the repression and then the massacre of 20 to 30,000 peasants in El Salvador over a period of just a few months out of a population of 1 million people. The current history goes back to a coup to try to overcome then a series of military rule since 1932 to 1979 when a military civilian government came into power. Included some elements from the left like Guillermo Ungo, but then that quickly dissolved by January of 1980. Then period of 1980-1981, very, very violent. Of course, the assassination of Romero, the North American religious women, people in the political structure, FDR, were assassinated in San Salvador. Then the formation of the FMLN. That was not until 1980, but it is a result of five political organizations that each of them have their military counterpart, and they came together as the FMLN. Looking at where does negotiations begin, really, you can look back. Well, Duarte came into power in 1984. There were the Contadora group, Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, Panama, September 1983, began to propose some ways to bring about peace in the Central America region. The United States Congress Bipartisan Commission Report, January of 1984, came with its proposal for achieving peace in the region. Duarte elected in May, and then several rounds of peace dialogues, which again did not achieve anything. And there, the FMLN came in with some strong demands for power sharing, declaring certain areas of El Salvador as their territory, merging the two armies, that is the FMLN with the regular army of El Salvador. Some of those are no longer the talking points of the FMLN. And then Cristiani comes to power June 1st, around the peace talks September, October. Finally, the frustration of those and the offensive. And now, peace talks again under the auspices of the United Nations as of the 4th of April of 1990. And that's a hopeful sign. And I kind of personally believe that the United Nations would not have entered into that process unless they had some reasonable hope of achieving peace. Like war itself, which begins incrementally, peace is a process. And peace can only be achieved little by little. There have to be good signs of faith along the way in that process. There was a second round in May where they agreed that a target date for a ceasefire within the war would be September of this year. And then leading up to then participation in some way by the FMLN in elections which are scheduled for March of 1991. The primary talking points at this point are the purging of the armed forces, and it's a self-purging, that they want the army itself to eliminate these people. Actually, the FMLN in October proposed a slate of about 60 people of the high command of the armed forces to be purged. They also want the separation of power. Right now you have the police and the armed forces under the Ministry of the Defense. Police and army would be separated. So you have a responsible police force rather than several police forces which act as an army. Sometimes you're out in the field and you run across the Treasury Police or the National Police, and they look identical. They carry the same weapons and they're equally as vicious and carry out some atrocities just like anyone else, and they don't do police work. And then a reduction of the armed forces. In 1980, there were 12,000 people in the regular armed forces. Now there are about 60,000 in the armed forces, given our U.S. military assistance. So those are the three features that relate to the military. And then some judicial reform, because it's clear that El Salvador is not going to go anywhere unless it has a capable judiciary system that can bring about a due process of law. And that relates to this, certainly, the purging of the armed forces, because there has been so much intimidation of judges and assassination expert judges that nobody wants to defend and pursue cases of the violation of human rights.
Who's killing the judges?
Pardon me?
Who's killing the judges? The army doing that, or the
it's
FMLN?
Right. The major cases, it appears that elements of the army or paramilitary structures have killed judges when it's come to critical identifying people related to the army or related to the right-wing elements. Now, the FMLN has killed, for example, a number of mayors, quite a number of mayors. And that was a political statement, certainly, you know, that they had told people in many areas of the country not to run for political office because they control those areas. And effectively, they do control those areas. Many of the mayors of many of the small towns throughout El Salvador do not live in their small towns, but live in like the municipal headquarters or the department capital. They're afraid, but they are elected by the few people that have moved back to those cities, and they conduct elections. So,
if you could put some percentages on how many people are involved in the various groups, like the government groups, the military, and then I take it there's a whole bunch of people who aren't part of those sort of extreme groups. There's a whole bunch of moderates or whatever. How does that work out?
It's clear that ARENA has a backing. Christian Democrats have less of a backing at the moment. I think it's hard to measure the support that the FMLN and their political allies have because of the fear factor, really, of coming out. But it's clear that they do have sizable support. How high that is, it is difficult to calculate. I would say that the vast majority of people are in this area of trying to seek a politically negotiated settlement to the war. And within that, I would put the churches, the Catholic Church, with the initiative of Bishop Rivera Damas for the National Debate for Peace, the Lutheran Church, the Baptist Church. And they can really inspire a lot of people along that line, calling both sides to serious negotiations and condemning both sides for the abuse of human rights.
But also not being willing to say, all right, let's just stop fighting and have everything
right.
Go on the way it has been. You know, they have suffered war now for 10 years and they're not about to just stop fighting without that having resulted in anything that benefits the
yeah.
people. So there's got to be
some
kind
substance
of peace with a social justice.
That means it's more than what you're talking about here.
Yes, but this is a minimum to go to these elections in March of 1991, when the idea then would be that perhaps ARENA would no longer have a majority in Congress or in the National Assembly, and that some other reforms would come about through regular congressional processes. And that's something that at this moment I think is even a product again of Nicaragua, where you let that judicial or that congressional process work. In fact, the FMLN basically wants to to promote democracy, what they call broad, ample democracy. Let the people speak, let the majority speak. What they see happens now is you've got an assembly that is dominated by such a small group of people, or represents a small strata of interests that do not represent the interests of the majority. To get perhaps a coalition, and this is what they're in fact talking about, even perhaps Christian Democrats with FMLN, FDR, however that looks, to defeat ARENA in the coming elections. We need to break it off at this point. I'm sorry, we have to do that. We'll perhaps see you throughout the week and at other sessions. Thank you very much.